It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered the street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
It's not hot.
You haven't been beat up properly. Woo!
Tomorrow night, or Tuesday at noon Japanese time, New Japan Pro Wrestling is hosting an online press conference that you can watch for free on New Japan World concerning the future of all New Japan events. New Japan President Harold Mage had said previously that they would only consider resuming live events after Japan lifted its state of emergency, which happened back on May 25th. So hopefully this will be the beginning of New Japan shows, probably empty arena shows, but hopefully the beginning of resuming of live events. They have not run a show since February 26th. New Japan has effectively been shut down for over 3 months now. They had to cancel the New Japan Cup. I think Genesis and their Wrestling Dontaku shows as well. If they can resume shows soon enough, and maybe it's not in the next couple of weeks, even in the next couple of months, the G1 should be safe. For those wondering, hey, what the hell happened to the G1? Thankfully for all you G1 fans, the G1 for the first time was pushed back to the fall. Had the G1 been scheduled for the summer, it's very possible there would be no G1. But because of the Olympics, which now, of course, has been postponed to next year, the G1 was moved to the fall. But you can never be sure, right? You can never be sure. Look, the NBA may be resuming its season next month, too. The end of July, all it takes is another spike, and they could all be back under lockdown. You know, I see Arizona's having a tough time now all of a sudden. Not good. Not good. This is episode 655 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, June 7th, 2020. I am the Solid Monster. Tonight is NXT TakeOver In Your House. I come with predictions, which I did not have a chance to do during the week, so we're going to get into the In Your House card for tonight. And some of the events from NXT this past week. I've got thoughts. I've got a recap, and I've got thoughts on Road Dogg's interview with Corey Graves and some of the comments that should raise the eyebrows of one NXT champion, Adam Cole, or maybe he is no longer the NXT champion. We just don't know it yet, right? His match with Velveteen Dream was taped cinematic style over a week ago. It's in the can. It's airing tonight. I'm going to get into all of that. But first, thank you to everybody who continues to use our Audible link and show us love on there. Keep doing so. If you've already used it, go ahead and share it with somebody else who you think might want to enjoy one free audiobook. All you got to do is sign up with our link for the 30-day trial, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Got tons of wrestling books. I've run through all of them these last few weeks as far as what you can choose from. And so take your pick. You get one freebie that you get to keep no matter what, audibletrial.com/solomonster. And of course, for those of you who would like to send a PayPal into the show, you can always do so, entirely up to you. thesolomonster.com. You'll see the PayPal link on the right hand side of the page. $10 or more, I'll get you a nickname and a shout out. And I want to show some love here. First sound off of the month of June to all of these fine folks, including the ambassador of disaster, Chase Wood, and Bad to the Bone, Brandon Joseph. You guys get top honors this week. Wow, is all I can say. So thank you to the two of you. Also, of course, thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Pissarra, Eugene Crazy Ass Morgan. Congrats on the new gig, Eugene. That's awesome. Killshot Keith Hart, the Chicago Slayer, Willie Eichard, Velvet Revolver, Robert Murray, Josh the Shooter Stockton, Stephen Handyman Halistic, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soap. It was pretty cool hearing from his brother Luke the other night on the Dynamite stream. Vicious Vincent Cooper, DeVenom John Eru, the Carolina Panther, Bradley Gooch, the Queen of Quidditch, Ashley Zarzor, Heartbreaker Jason Hargrove, the Lake George Lunatic Bobby Blanchard, Jersey Boy James Cecere, Mean Matt Forbush, Steve the Sully Monster O'Sullivan, Captain Faceass, what a name, Captain Faceass CJ Uehara, Jamar Ninetail Demon Fox Richardson, Jose Hangman Cora. Also want to say happy birthday to Cherubin, And happy birthday to the crazy cruiserweight Dalvin Brown, and a shout out to Brandon and Ashley out in Pennsylvania. Save the World, Sean Tilly, who wanted to wish a happy birthday to his friend Jason Martinez, who's also a big fan of the show, so I will co-sign happy birthday, Jason. Much love to Jacob Harrison. Hope Jacob is doing okay. He lost his grandmother this past week, Sharon Harrison. He says that she, too, is a big Hall & Oates fan. And he says that she always used to call him Jake the Snake when he was a kid. And so, Jacob, my condolences to you. I'm very sorry to hear that. And you are from now on, at least here on this show, you are from now on, Jake the Snake Harrison. The SoCal Saint, St. Clair Isuka, who runs a YouTube channel called Sainted Entertainment. You can find contact information on Twitter at SaintedEnt, that's E-N-T, or on Instagram at Sainted Entertainment. So give that a look. And last but not least, shout out to Just Alex on YouTube. Check out his channel. Just type in Alex, or Just Alex, rather, A-L-Y-X. We'll get you over to the channel. Lots of wrestling content and reviews and skits. Some very good ones up there. Help him reach 30,000 subs. He is tantalizingly close. So show some support to Alex and get him to 30K. And hey, Trigger Bear, thank you for the 5 stars and the love on iTunes. I appreciate that. Very sad to hear about the death of former CZW star Danny Havoc, who passed away last Sunday. This was after I had already recorded the show, but passed away last Sunday at the age of 34. He was a popular name in the deathmatch world. Tons of wrestlers tweeted their condolences. You know, for someone who was known for a career of death matches, he was apparently one of the nicest guys you could ever meet. I didn't read one negative word about the guy all week. It was, you know, it was touching to see all of these wrestlers and WWE wrestlers, people who knew him or at one time worked with him, just having nothing but glowing things to say. Apparently his wife had just passed away in April, unexpectedly from heart failure. And he just never got over it. He was extremely heartbroken over it. I mean, look, you really never get over losing someone like that. It wasn't that long ago that it happened, but I guess it affected him to the point where he lost his life. How exactly, we don't know. No cause of death, you know, has been publicly revealed. But one friend described him as inconsolable over the loss. And that's just very sad. It's just very sad. Jon Moxley, who does not tweet a whole lot, was all broken up about his death. He revealed on Twitter that he had asked Havoc to design his very first shirt, his very first t-shirt in AEW. That's the one with the grenade design. It says Mox on it, which is a pretty badass design. Apparently that is the product of Danny Havoc. And so again, I wanted to mention that just so everybody's aware. And obviously, I mean, that's just a terrible 34 years old, just a terrible situation. And Chris Hyatt also passed away this week, much like Larry Zonka, who also just died. He was a contributor for 411mania.com at one time, although he had not been a contributor on 411 for a very long time. I believe the last time he was writing for the site was back in 2004. But before that, maybe this is what he's more well known for, the old Scoops wrestling website back in the 90s. That takes me back. Those were the old internet wrestling days. Talking like mid-90s, late 90s. I mean, you know, every other week I take you guys down the RSPW road. That goes back even to the late 80s. Although I have not been able to find any posts from 1989, sadly, which I believe is when RSPW started, but old school wrestling days, when I think of Scoops, or Mikasa, or Online Onslaught, Scoop This was another, speaking of Scoops wrestling, Scoop This was another website that was basically a late 90s version of what Kayfabe News is today. I remember just sitting around laughing my ass off at the old Scoop This articles, but you know, Chris wrote a lot of wrestling reviews. He was known for that, so he did some humorous pieces over the years. He had been in poor health for a while. He passed away on Thursday. His cousin broke the news of his death on Chris's Twitter page. It's just, he and Larry Zonka dying so close to one another to me is just eerie. It's just very strange. We've unfortunately read a lot about death this year. And I wanted to make sure to acknowledge those two as well. If you missed it, I recorded over an hour talking about In Your House. This is, of course, this year, the 25th anniversary of the very first In Your House pay-per-view back in May of 95. So I did a whole YouTube extra talking about In Your House and ranking, in my opinion, the top 10 best In Your House, my favorite 10 best In Your House matches of all time. So that countdown, that video, is up on the YouTube channel if you did not see it. And In Your House also, of course, is being revived for one night only tonight. I had a lot of fun going back down memory lane, and I want your feedback on the top 10. So again, if you missed it, give it a watch on YouTube. Tonight is NXT TakeOver, In Your House, the first ever empty arena TakeOver show. I know they did some TakeOver matches on television in April from an empty Full Sail, but as a top-to-bottom full pay-per-view, this will be the first to be held with no fans. And that is worth noting because the live crowds at these TakeOver shows are as much a part of the show as anything. They're a part of the show in a way that enhances the TakeOvers. Usually people are going nuts, especially those big dramatic parts of some of the big matches in the main events. The fans, I don't think it can be overstated how much of an important part the fans usually play in these TakeOver shows. And I'm very interested to see, because these TakeOver shows are always received well. Even the TakeOver shows you might look at on paper and say, well, that's kind of a weaker card, this was not the best TakeOver, but rarely do we get anything but an excellent TakeOver show. And I'm very interested to see what the general sentiment is coming out of this particular show, if it's as enthusiastic as it normally would be for these shows. So what I'm going to do here, I'm going to run through the card, give my predictions, and along the way, I will mix in my thoughts on NXT from this week, so we'll just knock it out all at once. WWE has brought back Todd Pettengill. Brought him back for a 60-second In Your House promo video, and from what I understand, we may be seeing more of him tonight on the pay-per-view, which I hope we do. Todd is very underrated. He could be very corny. I mean, I remember him well when he started back in 93, you know, and living in New York, even through his entire WWE run, which went from, I guess, 93 probably to 97, right? I don't remember him doing any of 98, you know, and he was the one who recommended and got Michael Cole into the company. So you can blame Todd. But I remember he'd be on the radio here in New York on the Scott and Todd show, WPLJ radio, and yeah, he would talk about it. One time, Vince McMahon called in to the morning show to wish him a happy birthday, which was just bizarre to be listening to. I think he was cracking jokes on him and insulting him, and you know, but that was very nice of him to do, I guess. But corny as he was very good at his job. He was very, very good at getting people, I think, hyped for those pay-per-views and doing the pay-per-view rundown videos on the syndicated shows like Mean Gene used to do. He was very good, and I think there's value in using him if he's willing to do some more stuff, you know, not come back and work full-time per se, but, you know, they brought him in for the Royal Rumble watch-along a few months ago when they had the Rumble, was it in Houston, I guess it was in Houston this year, and they brought him in, you know, and he sat on the couch and he was just kind of watching along for just part of the pay-per-view, and then he disappeared. So he's done a few things, you know, they did an In Your House DVD a number of years ago, they had him host the In Your House DVD. I think his Slammy Awards songs from 96 and 97 should be on frickin' Spotify. So I am a big proponent of bringing Todd Pettengill back to do stuff like this. We have Mia Yim, Tegan Nox, and Shotzi Blackheart taking on Candice LeRae, Dakota Kai, and Raquel Gonzalez. All six women have had issues over the last several weeks. Tegan and Dakota going back even further than that to War Games when Dakota turned. On Wednesday, LeRae and Yim, they fought to a countout, then turned into a mixed tag with Johnny and Candice against Keith Lee, Mia Yim. Both men wrestled in street clothes. Gargano dug his car keys into, which he later called the keys to success. He dug his car keys out of his pocket and dug them into Keith Lee's eyeball. And that allowed Candice to roll up Mia for the win. I say split the cost here. You know, I don't think Keith Lee is losing his championship on this show, so Candice and company should get the win here. They're my pick. I think the heels have more to gain. Damian Priest goes one-on-one with Finn Balor. Balor is the one seeking revenge here. I think he should get the win because I don't believe this will be their final match. And if they do another one, then Priest should get the final win. Ultimately, you know, ultimately it should be about trying to help Damian Priest along and kind of elevate his star, not make him look inferior. One loss is not going to do that, but I think a one-and-done loss after he already failed to win the North American title from Keith Lee, that would do that. So I think Balor wins round one, and then the feud continues from there. Case in point, Karrion Kross. Karrion Kross takes on Tommaso Ciampa. Here's an instance where Kross struck first. Ciampa is the one seeking revenge, right? Like Balor in his feud. But Kross here has to win. This should be a no-brainer. It is his first big match in NXT. You want to establish him as a major threat. He has to win here. There can be no debate about this. I also don't see this as a one-and-done program. But in this case, I would have him win the second one too. And just because he wins tonight doesn't mean he shouldn't win the next one either. This guy needs to be protected. And Ciampa is a great opponent for him to work with. Who can, you know, he can put him over like a monster and not really lose anything in the process. You know, Ciampa's a Teflon man. He's a Teflon guy in NXT. He's Mr. NXT. He's already said he has no aspirations of moving to Raw or SmackDown. I don't even think he was joking when he said this, but he has said previously that if he ever finds out they want to call him over to Raw or call him over to SmackDown, he'll quit. He'll retire. He would rather retire than go to Raw or SmackDown. I don't blame the guy. But so basically, he is Mr. NXT. He and Gargano both probably. I don't see them going anywhere. Not anytime soon. But this is the role, I think, that he needs to play in this match. Star maker. Scarlett is already a star, right? So he's got Scarlett in his corner. He's got the cool entrance. Now he needs to back that up and win. You can have a great manager. You can have a cool entrance or a cool theme song. It doesn't mean shit if you don't win matches. Charlotte Flair defends the NXT Women's Championship against Rhea Ripley and Io Shirai in a triple threat match. We got what they called on Wednesday a prime target feature previewing the match. Kind of like a little mini documentary on each woman and their preparations and their training for TakeOver. This was excellent. This was excellent stuff. They showed Rhea getting up at 5:30 in the morning, even though she says, I don't have to. I do it anyway because I have to train. I have to be the best that I can be. Charlotte talked about being a product of the PC as they showed her training in a ring at the PC. It's where she won her first NXT Women's Championship from Natalya, which was a great match, by the way. Beth Phoenix was interviewed, gave a history lesson on Io Shirai, all of her accomplishments. My eyes even spied a very brief cameo from Okada in some of the footage they showed. Putting the NXT Women's title back on Charlotte was a mistake. Rhea Ripley never should have lost at WrestleMania. They put the title on Charlotte to try to improve the ratings for NXT, and it has been a failed experiment. Instead, Charlotte has been overexposed. The most overexposed star in the company at the moment is Charlotte Flair. And they've also used it as an excuse, and this is why she is overexposed. They've used this as an excuse to put her on every show, instead of keeping her exclusive to NXT like they've done with Finn Balor. She's on NXT 1 week, she's on Raw the next week, she's on SmackDown the week after that. I don't see Asuka popping up on SmackDown. I don't see Bayley popping up in NXT. Charlotte Flair is everywhere. I said last week, I'm surprised she hasn't shown up yet on 205 Live. Maybe she has. I don't watch 205 Live. Maybe she has. I said, get her in the ring with Lindsay Dorado. They might have a good match. So she has just been all over the place. And yes, people will say, but she's good. She's really good at her job. You know what? I don't care how good she is. It's too much. It's too much, and she should absolutely drop the championship here in this match. The only question should be, not should she lose, the question should be, who should she lose to? Who walks out with the championship? Does Charlotte even take the pin? Maybe she doesn't. Rhea never should have lost. And Io is one of the best that they have, and she's never been the champion. Charlotte's a two-time champion. Rhea's been champion, albeit for a few, only like 3 months, I think. Io Shirai has never been NXT Women's Champion. They could get a second chance here to do right by Rhea. They could tell a little redemption story. She was young and cocky and got too big for her britches, and now she's got to fight her way back and work her way back. I would assume that's the idea that Triple H is thinking of. He did an interview this past week, and he said that he thought the best thing that could have happened was Rhea Ripley losing at WrestleMania. He said, for her long-term story arc. Well, that's a long-term arc that has to play out for me to buy into that. I don't know that I buy that. But even though they could do right by Rhea and put the belt back on her here, if it were me, I give it to Io. Unless they know that she's leaving, which is something I have not heard about that. I've not read anything about Io Shirai specifically. There's been those rumors about Kairi Sane. And for Kairi's health, fleeing back to her home country to get away from Nia Jax doesn't sound like a terrible idea. But I've not heard anything about Io. I'm going with Io Shirai. I'm picking Io Shirai to win her first championship, and I want to see her pin Charlotte to do it. She had a singles match with Charlotte a few weeks ago. Charlotte couldn't get the job done. She cheated. She took a kendo stick, and she got herself disqualified. Then they had the tag match where I think she had used the ropes to get the pin. Io needs to get her win over Charlotte by pin. And I want to see her use the moonsault to do it, which is her finish. So if she's going to pin Charlotte, it probably would be with the moonsault. That would be an appropriate finish. Beat Charlotte with a better version of her own move. Keith Lee defends the North American Championship against Johnny Gargano. I'm torn on this one. I don't believe that Keith Lee should lose the title yet, but the only name that makes sense as his next challenger after Gargano is Karrion Kross, because what other heel is there that he has not already mixed it up with? We've seen him in there with Dijakovic. We've seen him in there with Damian Priest. Dexter Lumis is getting a push, but he's not necessarily a heel at the moment, and that's certainly not something I would do, is have him beat Keith Lee. What other big heel is there? Outside of maybe in a couple of months, Karrion Kross gets the next shot. Well, if Karrion Kross is going to be considered for the next shot, he'd be more likely to beat a babyface for the championship than a heel Gargano. But I could also see there being interest in them bringing Lee to Raw or bringing Lee over to SmackDown. Matt Riddle just got the call. Looks like Dijakovic is going to be next. I'm going to say they wait a little bit longer on moving Lee off of NXT. Keep the title on him. Maybe Gargano gets disqualified so they could do it again. But Gargano really could use a big win having just turned heel. So that's why I say this is one of the harder ones, I think, to predict, because this one really could go either way. But I'm going to stick with Keith Lee to retain as my prediction. And then in the one taped match on this show, taped over a week ago, it is Adam Cole, the longest reigning NXT champion of all time, been champion now for over a year, defending his title in a first ever NXT backlot brawl. Obviously, it's not the first backlot brawl in WWE history. Roddy Piper and Goldust had a very famous one at WrestleMania. But the first ever NXT backlot brawl against the Velveteen Dream. And if the Velveteen Dream loses, if the Velveteen Dream falls short of becoming the new NXT champion, and obviously in a backlot brawl, there's not going to be a count out, there's not going to be a disqualification. So if he loses, he will not be able to challenge for the NXT title again, so long as Adam Cole is the champion. I see some people saying, you know, well, obviously, you know, if he's going to win, because if he loses, the stipulation is that he can never again challenge, like the Cody thing in AEW. If you go back and you watch the segment with Adam Cole and William Regal, what Adam Cole said was, as long as I have this title, he will not be allowed to challenge for it. So I take that to be the stipulation here. Now, on Wednesday's NXT show, they aired a Prime Target mini-documentary for this match as well. Also well done, not as good as the one on the women, though the women's one was better. Cole, they showed him out celebrating his year as champion with the other members of Undisputed Era. They even ate out at a nice restaurant, which the rest of us peons still can't do, because none of the sit-down restaurants are even open, at least here in New York. I think I'm good anyway, eating out at restaurants for a while. Maybe next year. Maybe next year. Delivery is fine with me. But meanwhile, Dream, they show Dream, he's out rollerblading. He's talking into his magic mirror. I said last week that Velveteen Dream has never felt colder than he does right now. But Adam Cole has had that championship for over a year. What else is there for him to do? There is nothing else that he could possibly do in this role as NXT champion. And for the Velveteen Dream, it's probably now or never. He's already been beaten by Cole. Are you going to beat him again? It's a backlot brawl. It was already, like I said, taped over a week ago. Apparently they were outside. I guess maybe it rained, so they had to hold off a little bit. They were out there taping out behind Full Sail on the parking lot until 1:30 in the morning. This is going to be one of those cinematic matches. I like the ones that they've done so far, by and large. I mean, the Boneyard match at WrestleMania was great. The Money in the Bank stuff was entertaining enough. Ciampa and Gargano, you know, had a good match on NXT a while back. This one should be good, too. I think they put the title on Dream, and he gets his run with it. And so long as he can keep changing the passcode on his phone, then he should be okay. So I will be back with you live tonight after TakeOver on YouTube for a full recap, so I hope you'll join me then. Just in case you don't get the notification, check the channel. I'll get the event page up probably about an hour or so before the show ends, and we can get the chat going. Some other notes from this week's NXT. May as well tackle the rest of this now. Breezango is back. Fandango had come back, then he got hurt again, so he went right back up on the shelf. And so now he is back. He is all healed up from his latest injury. They made their return as the mystery team in a triple threat with Undisputed Era and the team of Oney Lorcan and Danny Burch. Lorcan and Burch just got the video package treatment last week. They've been in NXT for how many years now? They only first gave them a video package. Like a nice personality profile type deal, like talking about who they are and how they came together. And it made me think, okay, they're going to get a little bit of a mini push. Maybe they're going to be next in line for a shot at the belts. They just got the video package treatment. I thought they were winning here. They were getting the next shot against Imperium, but they went with Breezango instead. They are now next in line for a championship match. Imperium walked out right after that. Out behind them comes Malcolm Bivens with his team, Indushare. Remember Indushare? They made a debut how many weeks ago now, and then we never saw him again. Apparently they were going to feud with Matt Riddle. Plans changed for Riddle. Now he's coming to SmackDown, and so it's kind of fucked up all these different plans they had for about half a dozen different people. Pete Dunne, Timothy Thatcher, Indushare. You know, when one domino falls, it knocks down a whole bunch of other dominoes here. I get the sense this Matt Riddle call-up was not planned long-term. So, anyway, from one three-way, they're now apparently teasing another three-way, since we saw these two teams walk out. It was good to see Santana Garrett get a rare NXT win in a rare appearance on NXT. When she does wrestle, she usually doesn't win. She beat Aaliyah. Aaliyah lost. Robert Stone came to ringside all disheveled after Chelsea Green had fired him the week before. She may be getting called up too. He was not impressed with Aaliyah's loss. He looked like he hadn't slept in a week. So good for him. They are turning this, you know, into a storyline. I wasn't sure if they were kind of splitting him and Chelsea up because Robert Stone was on the cutting block. So for his sake, that's a good thing. Cameron Grimes pinned Bronson Reed with the cave-in, which still sucks. The cave-in, or at least watching it the way that he does it, looks like shit. I'll say it all the time. And El Hijo del Fantasma took on Drake Maverick in the finals of the Interim Cruiserweight Championship Tournament, which I don't believe they were even referring to it as interim by the end here. The winner is now just the Cruiserweight Champion. I could not have nailed this any better. The way this went down exactly the way that I predicted it would last week. Fantasma wins the title. The Lucha Ninjas run out. They gave him the assist, whether intended or unintended. They gave him the assist. Drake Maverick saw what was going on. He saw them come out near the end. He did a dive out onto the ninjas, and they scattered. Right? We had Phantasma. Took him back in the ring, finished him off, won the championship. And then after the match, as Maverick did this big dramatic exit, I mean, you could see where this was going, right? I mean, I said last week, it's the Cedric Alexander thing. Yeah, I was talking about it on Wednesday as well. This was the whole Cedric Alexander thing where he fell just short in the Cruiserweight Classic, and then out comes Triple H listening to the sounds of the audience, telling him to sign Cedric, and he comes out and says, okay, and he puts his arm around the guy and takes him to the back. So he's really teasing this thing out. He's, you know, fake crying and all this stuff. And out walks Triple H with a contract in his hand, an NXT contract in his hand. He did not even give Maverick a chance to read this thing. He did not. He just handed him a pen, and Maverick signed it. That thing was like 10 pages long. The man probably just signed a 10-year deal at half the pay and doesn't even realize it. Good for Drake Maverick on getting his job back. I don't begrudge him for being part of this. I don't begrudge him. Look, the guy is once again gainfully employed. I can't hate on that. But I will reiterate what I said previously. I think the way this whole thing went down was tacky as shit. I was not a fan of this. You know, the fact that they fired this guy, which they did. I know there's a lot of debate about that. Oh, did they fire him? Was it a work all along? They fired him. He was part of the cuts. They allowed him to finish his dates for the tournament. He won the fans over. He ended up getting his job back. They turned it into a storyline. Meanwhile, all the other people who got cut at a very dubious time here, although, you know, again, certainly WWE is far from the only company cutting people during a pandemic. But a lot of people got cut, a lot of very talented people, unfortunately. Some people they weren't doing anything with, but others it was a surprise to hear some of the names that got cut. But a whole bunch of people lost their job. And in this case, they decided, let's turn this into a storyline. Now, I saw Leo Rush. Leo Rush, he's been known to say some things. He went on Twitter. He said, man, are they going to hire everyone back then? Kind of a slap in the face to use this as a shoot work. But I guess I'm not surprised. Super happy for anyone getting their job back. But damn, real trauma and a lot of others were a part of this. I don't disagree with what he is saying there. But this is the same Leo Rush that also posted a joke tweet about Emma after she got released from WWE. Which he did later apologize for. Let me just say that. But the irony of that was not lost on me when I read that tweet. Hopefully he has learned from that experience, because he got a shit ton of heat. Not just from the fans, but from a lot of his peers, when he tweeted that stupid shit out a few years ago. You know what else bothered me? Is that Phantasma's big championship win. They've been dragging this tournament out now for weeks and weeks. Phantasma's big title win was totally overshadowed by the Drake Maverick stuff. Maverick lost. And his story overshadowed Phantasma becoming the new Cruiserweight champion. His story became more important than the tournament itself. Which I'm sure was never the plan from the beginning of it, until the whole thing turned into a storyline, and then it just ended up overshadowing everything. And so he felt like a total afterthought after all these weeks of the tournament playing out on TV. He just felt like more of an afterthought than he should have. You know, once Jordan Devlin is able to travel again, he's got the other Cruiserweight belt. We're going to be getting, I assume we're going to be getting at some point Devlin and Phantasma, though, which should be a fantastic match. Road Dogg joined Corey Graves on his After the Bell podcast this week and had some interesting comments. Interesting in how honest he was, almost refreshingly honest. Especially for somebody on the inside, as inside as he is in WWE. But also alarming in how honest he was on some of these things. First, he said that he will be 10 years sober in October. Sober in October. That rhymes. I guess if he ever writes a book, I just gave him the title for it. But that's awesome. That's awesome news. He had a lot of substance abuse problems before. You know, one of the many guys back, especially during that whole late 90s period, that had, you know, just drug problems and just various issues. And he has stayed, you know, clean now for a very long time. He says he still attends meetings on a daily basis down in Orlando, right down the road from the PC. So good for him. Hopefully we never have to see a Dark Side of the Ring special on the Road Dog Jesse James. So that's a cool thing. But then he got into some of the WWE, you know, kind of the way they do things down in NXT and at the PC and promos and things of that nature. And it was fascinating to listen to. But on the scripting of promos for talent, for example, he talked about that. And all of the micromanaging that the company does. This is what he had to say about that. He said, there are some talent nowadays that you can trust to fill in the blanks. And there's definitely some talent that you cannot trust. So as far as the micromanaging goes, I was guilty of that for sure. People up the ladder from me are too. But it's because of that. There are so few that you can just go, yeah, I can let him go and he's not going to say the wrong thing and he's not going to do the wrong thing. It's actually better if I just let him be him or I let her be her. There are so few people like that. Now, I can understand his point. WWE is a publicly traded company. We've also seen a lot of WWE talents go on social media over the years and post some really stupid shit. Right? We've all seen it. Uh-oh, so-and-so's just tweeted again. Now what have they said? Now they went and put their foot in their mouth. How many times have we heard about dumb wrestler tweets? Twitter is one of the worst things to happen to the wrestling business. Some wrestlers have also, on the other hand, though, used it to get themselves over. But more often than not, I feel, it has been a tool of destruction. The destruction of their own careers. And so now imagine if someone like Road Dogg went up to, you know, Jackson Ryker, I'll use him as an example, and said, hey, here's the main point. You got to go out there. You got 6 minutes. Good luck. Here's a microphone. And he just sent him out there, right? There's no telling what might come out of the guy's mouth. And you can substitute anybody in that spot. I just use Ryker as he's the first name that came to mind because he was in the news this week, getting raked over the coals. But there's no telling what might come out of the guy's mouth. You put a live microphone in his hand without much in the way of guidance. I'm not even talking about dropping the F-bomb or anything like that, which I'm sure is a concern. Like, oh, what if they cuss? But it doesn't have to be curse words. If they go out there and they get lost, or they go out there and they think, oh man, I gotta say something. I gotta say something witty, you know, to get myself over, or I gotta get myself noticed. I gotta get people talking about me. And then they make some kind of social statement, or they make a tasteless joke, you know, that they think is funny. That's going to blow back on the company, and it's probably going to be the end of their career. It always makes me think of Abraham Washington. Remember him? Remember the guy they named after two presidents? Because this was during a period where their naming of folks was just out of control. Fucking Eli Cottonwood. Need I say more? That was a rant on the Sound Up from many years ago. The NXT names. Those were the days. But it makes me think of him. It makes me think of Abraham Washington and the Kobe Bryant rape joke that he made on TV. That was the end of Abraham Washington. You have not heard about him. You have not heard from him since. WWE had to go scramble. They had to go issue an apology. He made the company look terrible. I mean, the company's been making itself look terrible for years, but he made them look worse, and he got fired over it. He lost his job. And he actually was a good talker. That was kind of the sad part about the whole thing. He was, at the time, I believe, right, he was the manager, right, or the agent for probably the primetime players. And he was a very good talker. You know, he had that gift of gab. He had a charisma about him. I think he had been a wrestler, but they were using him in the managerial role. But he improvised, and he went too far. And also, that was right around the time, I think, that Linda McMahon may have been running for Senate. That probably didn't help. I mean, he would have gotten in trouble no matter what. But that probably had as much to do with it as anything. Just bad timing. He improvised, and he paid the price for it. So I get what Road Dogg is saying in that respect. I understand why they may feel the need to do that. But what does that say? Think about this. What does that say about their talent roster or the way that they teach them and coach them at the Performance Center that you have somebody like Road Dogg, who is deeply embedded in that system, right? Very close with Triple H, works with him, Shawn Michaels. You know, and at one time was like the lead writer even for SmackDown. Now he's with NXT, but, you know, again, deeply embedded behind the scenes in that company, openly admitting that there are very few talents that they can trust to go out there and not fuck up. That is a very distressing thing to hear. I know they have promo classes at the PC because people have talked about them, even after Dusty Rhodes passed away. I don't know who teaches them now. Maybe it's a rotating staff that does so, but they have promo classes at the PC. I don't know what the curriculum is. I've never sat in on one of those classes, so maybe they're already doing this. But if that's the case, then they need to prioritize teaching these people how to think on their feet, what to do, what not to do when you're out there without a net. If you ever get lost, here's a device, you know, one of these mental devices that you can use. Like, there have to be ways that you can try to kind of coach and teach people the do's and don'ts when you find yourself with a microphone in your hand standing in the middle of the ring when you're on live TV, because not everyone is going to be good at memorizing lines. You will forget your lines from time to time. If you're Randy Orton, you simply walk over to Sheamus on live TV and go, "What's my line?" And you're good to go. But for the rest of them who are not Randy Orton, you're not going to be able to walk up to your opponent on live TV and ask them, "Hey, dude, what's my line?" Why does it seem like this is not a priority in this company? What does that say about the way that they are teaching these people when it comes to promos? Because overly scripted promos are one of the worst things to happen to wrestling in the last 20 years. I was happy to hear Drew McIntyre recently. He did an interview and he said that he has been given the leeway largely to cut his own promos. He will sometimes be handed stuff and he'll, I don't know if he'll throw it away, but he'll kind of just say, "You know what? I'm going to make it my own." We need more people who are given the leeway or have the courage to say, "Hey, give me the shot here. Let me make this my own. Don't give me this, you know, pre-written, like inhuman sounding content, robotic content or dialogue to recite, because I'm going to sound like a fucking idiot. Let me do my own thing." For McIntyre, I was happy to hear him say that. Not everybody is going to have the kind of leeway that Drew McIntyre has. I'm willing to bet that guys like Samoa Joe, Kevin Owens, they probably also get that leeway. They're also very, very good talkers. I'm sure they don't have to recite scripted promos. They'll have their stupid buzzwords like everybody does. Make sure you say WWE Universe. Make sure you say, you know, whatever the fucking buzzword of the week is. But they're probably left to their own devices to go out and say what they want to say, as long as they hit the main points. That's the way it should be. But to hear right from the horse's mouth that they have such little faith in their own talent to go out there and talk without screwing up, that should be alarming to everyone who hears that. That is, at least partly, you have to say, a failing of their own system. He also said this. There's a lot more lately, especially with promos. They're including talent. John Cena used to sit in the writer's room for 8 hours. He would say, "Hey, what do you think about this?" and then spit out a line. And his promos were gold, right? Because he spent the time. A lot of wrestlers will get their promo and go, "Okay, cool, yeah, I like this." All right, well, it's your character. If you're a wrestler and you have a 10-minute segment where it's a promo and a match, and you don't take the time to make sure that it's the best it could possibly be, that ain't on the writer, that ain't on Vince McMahon, as much as you would like to put it there, that's on the talent. And agreed, the talent should want their promo, or their segment, to be the best that it can be. And maybe they do have some men or women on that roster who are content to just take what they're given, and just do the bare minimum and just do what they're told. And not do anything to try to make it better. But, you know, to say that ain't on the wrestler. And it's not on Vince McMahon. It's on the talent. How deep in the bubble do you have to be? Here's a 10-minute promo and a match. Here's how we want it done. Maybe you get a little bit of leeway, maybe you don't. I guess it depends on who you are. If Road Dogg is to be believed, they obviously have little faith in a lot of the people who work there to ad-lib on their own. So right there, they're already constrained by what's being given to them because they don't trust them. Well, how are you supposed to build trust? How do you get to a point where you can build trust if you're not being given, you know, the leeway to go out there and kind of do your own thing? I mean, you don't think that there are talents who do try to make the most of what they're given, and it still sucks because they're limited in what they can do with it? I mean, bad creative is still bad creative. Bad verbiage is still bad verbiage. Do you hear some of the promos that they script for these people? I mean, a lot of you don't. I know that because a lot of you don't even watch WWE anymore, so I'll tell you. I hear it, and it sucks. No human being on the planet, not named McMahon, would talk the way that some of these people talk on TV. And it has a lot to do with the words that they are forced to memorize. So to say, you know, well, that's on the talent, don't blame the wrestlers and don't blame Vince McMahon, you know, kind of passing the buck. If you give me a pile of shit and you tell me, hey, make it the best pile of shit that you can possibly make it, no matter how good that pile of shit may look, if I stick my finger in it, And I draw a smiley face, at the end of the day, it is still a pile of shit. To listen to him speak, you would think the writers and Vince McMahon are blameless. Completely blameless in this. We just don't get it. They are completely blameless when we see things on TV that are no good. Or that don't sound any good. Now, that being said, if you have some people who are content to just coast and they're not actively trying to get better at their promos, then yes, they also bear responsibility in that. I am not saying that they are blameless. My whole point is that nobody is blameless when we see awful things like this on television. You have to spread the responsibility around, and to make a comment like that and say, oh, I know everybody would love to just put the blame on Vince McMahon. But Vince McMahon, if he didn't have a direct hand in the dialogue, and he probably did, knowing how hands-on he is with a lot of this shit, he certainly approves it. Everything runs through him. But even if that wasn't the case, the buck stops with him. You take responsibility, brother. It's your show. It's your show. It's this. You've created this system. This is the system that you helped create. This is the system that you wanted. This is the product of this system. You know, I understand with the wrestlers, though, I understand that everybody is mostly concerned about going out and having the best match and doing the highest dive and what can I do in the ring. But look, if you get a contract to work in WWE, you should know what you're getting yourself into. And if promos are not your strong suit, then you should work to try to improve that element of your game, because we all know how promo heavy WWE is. Just watch any of the shows. NXT less so. There does seem to be more of a reliance on you know, the in-ring stuff. More than probably Raw and SmackDown. But anybody who watches WWE can see how promo intensive it can be. If there are people who are not working to improve that, then yes, you're not going to get opportunities that you may feel that you deserve. You have to be willing to put the work in. I don't think anybody would argue otherwise. I don't think anybody would debate that. But let's not pretend that the creative forces behind the scenes don't shoulder some of that blame when it comes to the things that we see on television. The talents are only as good as what they're given to work with. And then he had this to say about Adam Cole, who he singled out as his favorite NXT star. Says Adam Cole is the most professional, the most talented. He just gets every aspect of it. He can cut a promo. He's one of the guys where you just go, I need you to do a minute, and that's all you say to him. And he gives you a minute of hiccupless verbiage. I've never heard that before. I've never heard it put that way before. Hiccupless verbiage that just makes you go, okay, that was perfect. Thank you. Every single time. That's Adam Cole in a nutshell. He's also a great worker. He has great psychology. I know some people are going to disagree with that. We'll get into that, but he said he's a great worker, he's got great psychology, Man, if he was Karrion Kross's size, he would be the Universal Champion right now. And if he wasn't, I would be wondering why. He is a dream superstar. I'm surprised he admitted that publicly. Not that Adam Cole was his favorite, but the whole thing about, well, if he was Karrion Kross's size, he'd be the Universal Champion or the WWE Champion right now. Surprised to hear him put it that way, so bluntly, but I think we all kind of knew this mindset was still there, that unless the crowd suddenly grabs a hold of you the same way they did somebody like Daniel Bryan and kind of forces the company into putting the belt on you, if you don't look the part, it's going to be a lot harder for you than it would be if, you know, you were 6'3", 240 pounds. And there are a lot of smaller guys on that roster, more so now than ever before, I think, in the history of the company. I mean, even if you took 205 Live away, you still have more smaller wrestlers, physically smaller, on the roster today, on television today, than you did 10, 15, 20, 30 years ago. Absolutely. But I still believe that if you have the size, not even the talent necessarily, but if you have a certain look and you have the size, you've got big muscles, you're always going to get more opportunities. You may not succeed. We've seen a lot of duds come along who, you know, got a big win on TV and then they were never seen again. I always think of, what's his name, Jackson Andrews. I mean, I there's probably a whole list of guys like that. But you're always going to get more opportunities than the guy who's 5'9", 5'10", 5'11", 180 pounds, 190 pounds, unless your name is Rey Mysterio. Even if that guy has talent that the other person doesn't. It has always been a struggle for smaller talents. It's always going to be. That's not going to change. It will always be a struggle, certainly in this company, so long as the mindset is what it is in WWE. The reality is, he's not wrong. If Adam Cole looked like Karrion Kross, but with the promo ability and the in-ring ability that Adam Cole has, Vince McMahon would have had the WWE title on him 2 years ago. He would never have spent as long, if even a single day, in NXT. It would have been like AJ Styles. They would have called him right up. So in that regard, he's not wrong. But if I'm Adam Cole, I know there's been talk lately about Adam Cole's contract coming due, possibly in August. He was asked about that this week in an interview. He did not give a direct answer about it. There's also a report out there that Cole signed a new 3-year deal just last year. So who knows what the truth is. I got a scoop for you. Adam Cole either did or did not sign a new contract last year. There's breaking news. Okay, so we're right back where we were, meaning nobody knows a fucking thing. But whatever his contractual situation is, if I'm Adam Cole, and I'm hearing those comments, while I appreciate the fact that I'm Road Dogg's favorite, that is setting off some alarm bells for me. And it has to be, on some level, demoralizing for him to hear. Oh, we love this guy. He's the best. He can wrestle. He can talk. He can do it all. What do you call him? A dream superstar. But man, if only he was 6 inches taller. Look, Adam Cole is not a big person. He is not a physically imposing person. I don't know what they bill him at. They might bill him at 6 feet. If they do, that's complete bullshit. There's no way he is more than 5'8 or 5'9. Under 200 pounds. There's no way. He is not a muscle guy. He does not look like a guy that's going to impress anybody because, you know, oh, he's cut, he's ripped, he's got big muscles. That's not Adam Cole. And yes, if you are not a WWE fan and you took one look at Adam Cole, you saw him in an airport, you saw him walking down the street, you saw him in a department store, you saw him at a restaurant, you would never think that this man is a professional wrestler. And in fact, Adam Cole admitted as much when he was on Edge and Christian's podcast a couple of years ago. He said because of his size, many, many times he is asked, hey, do you work in the WWE office? He said the worst are the TSA agents at the airport. When he was the North American champion in NXT, the agents would take the belt out of his bag when he was going through airport security. And they would ask him, they would go, what's this? And he would say, oh, that's a championship. And they would ask, for what? And he would say, oh, you know, for wrestling. And they couldn't believe it. They would look at the belt. They would look back at him. They would look back at the belt. They would look back at him. They would have these bewildered looks on their faces. He would tell them that he worked for WWE, and they would automatically think that he worked in the office for WWE. And then he would have to explain to them, no, I'm a wrestler. I actually wrestle for them. So Road Dogg is just saying what they're really thinking, what the company is really thinking. I'm not saying that I, you know, disagree, that at first glance, Adam Cole does not look like your prototypical professional wrestler. He doesn't. But neither does Daniel Bryan, neither does Sami Zayn, neither does Kevin Owens. But what do they have that helped get them over? In the ring, they can go, and they can talk. Owens and Zayn are better at promos than Bryan is, although Bryan has gotten better over the years. He still doesn't even consider himself a great promo, but, you know, he's a lot better than he used to be. But he's not Kevin Owens, and he's not Sami Zayn. But they are all good at talking, and they're good at getting you either to hate them or to love them. Adam Cole has that. Adam Cole has all of those things. He can do all of those things. He can do them well. So I think despite his size, I have to believe that despite his size, I think he'll do well. Does that mean that he's going to be the Universal Champion or the WWE Champion? Maybe not. But that doesn't mean he still can't do well on Raw or on SmackDown. History is on his side. When you look at the list of former NXT champions, okay, now he is the longest reigning NXT champion of all time. If you look at that list of all the former NXT title holders, most of them have gone on to have real success on the main roster. Kevin Owens, Sami Zayn, Finn Balor, Samoa Joe, Nakamura, Drew McIntyre now, Aleister Black, he's well on his way. The NXT title actually largely has a good track record, I mean, Bo Dallas aside, largely has a good track record of guys who went on to have success at that Raw or SmackDown level, at least for a while. Cole is somebody who does not embarrass the company whenever he opens his mouth. He's a credit to it. He is a credit to the company. And he has all the tools except for the size. There is nothing exceptional about the way that Adam Cole looks. There is nothing exceptional about the way that he dresses. There is nothing exceptional about the way he carries himself. That is his biggest flaw. But I don't think it is a fatal flaw. I think he can overcome it. To hear Road Dogg say it out loud, though, has to be demoralizing. But if you are a smaller guy, no matter how hard you work, you will always have to work twice as hard to get your spot and to keep your spot. It all boils down to, what do you look for as a fan in your pro wrestling? I would pose this question to all of you. Are you the kind of fan who looks for believability above all else? The guy has to look the part. He has to look like he can legitimately kick someone's ass in order for me to buy into him as a threat or a champion or a contender. Is that what is most important to you? There are smaller wrestlers who have an MMA background or who train MMA, or someone like Chad Gable, who was an Olympian. He was an Olympic wrestler, although his whole gimmick now is how short he is. Adam Cole is not one of those people. Adam Cole is not known for his MMA skills. He's not known for being a fighter. He's not, you know, his great amateur wrestling skills. He's not a body guy. So you're going to have people who look at him and think, I can't buy this guy in a top spot. This is a joke. Or are you on the other end where, as a fan, it's just important that you be entertained by your pro wrestling and great matches and great promos, regardless of how big or small the person may be? What do you look for in pro wrestling? That's a loaded question. And I'm sure I'm going to get a dozen or more different answers. I mean, look, remember, even someone like Ric Flair, and this goes to the whole thing about how subjective it all is, and it's all a matter of perspective. Even someone like Ric Flair, who people think is the greatest of all time, or one of the greatest of all time, gets a fair amount of hate. Even people like Bruno Sammartino, people in the business, legends in the business, like Bruno Sammartino and Bret Hart and Ole Anderson. Well, I mean, Ole Anderson hates everybody. But these are Flair's contemporaries. Would talk about, oh, he can only wrestle one match. Ric Flair was the shits. He was the most overrated star in the history of wrestling. He only could wrestle one match. Bret Hart and Bruno said the exact same thing. He only knew how to do one match. And then he would do the goofy stuff like the Flair flop and all that kind of stuff. And all he did was chop, you know, 82% of his matches and stuff. I think it's a generational thing with these wrestlers. Carl Gotch once called Harley Race a clown for working the style that he didn't. Coming off the top rope with the diving headbutts. He called him like a kamikaze man, he called him. Coming off the top rope like a kamikaze pilot with the big diving headbutt. Killing the business, he said, is what Harley Race was doing. He said nobody would ever do that in a real fight. This guy's a clown. You look at the way that somebody like Jim Cornette today looks at the Young Bucks. That's the way Carl Gotch looked at Harley Race 30 years ago. You know, today with people like Adam Cole, I hear it all the time. The old Kevin Nash vanilla midget argument. All these wrestlers with their dives and their 10,000 kickouts. And I will say, I do wish they would tone it down with all the kicking out of finishers and Adam Cole's matches. And it's not fair to just single him out because I feel like everybody does it now. We see it in AEW. We see it across promotions all over the place. But it's also noticeable in Adam Cole's matches as well. It has infected the entire wrestling business. And I wish it would stop that and dives in every single match has got to go. And look, the kicking out of finishers and stuff. I'm not saying that it has to die where it just doesn't happen. I just think it's overdone. Like the dives. A well-placed dive here and there is cool. It's a cool visual. But when everybody starts to do dives, it means nothing anymore. First time I saw Luke Harper do a dive in a WWE match, I said, well, we've officially jumped the shark now. You know, it's one thing to see the Usos go flying over the top rope or Rey Mysterio or somebody like that. But then you got Luke Harper doing dives. And I'm trying to think. There are other big guys, too, who had no business doing moves like that. I mean, Undertaker at least would save it for WrestleMania mostly. Like, you didn't see it in every single Undertaker match. All that shit is completely overdone. But anyway, that's a whole other rant. But again, I leave you with this. Do you believe that Adam Cole will be champion on Raw or SmackDown one day? And do you believe Adam Cole should be champion? That's two different questions. Do you think he will be, and do you think he should be? Sound off and let me know. Some thoughts on Raw from this past week. Seth Rollins and Aleister Black had a very good match to open the show. I thought it was the best part of the 3 hours. Those two worked very well together. That could be a pay-per-view main event one day down the road for a championship. Black won with a roll-up. Murphy and Theory attacked him after the bell. Humberto, who ran down in the middle of the match to his theme music to help even the odds, was attacked. He was curb-stomped. Rollins curb-stomped Black. Apollo Crews, we talked about the fact last week that he was going to be challenging someone. We didn't know who. Choosing someone to defend his championship, his new U.S. title against. That person turned out to be Kevin Owens. A friend of his. All of a sudden, a newfound friend of his. Solid match until the bullshit DQ finish with Andrade and Angel Garza running out and attacking both guys. That then turned into a tag team match. Andrade tried to pin Cruz with his feet on the ropes. Apollo kicked out one with a spinning sit-out powerbomb. The non-finish with Owens, at least, it does leave the door open to something more between them. I'm still thinking we may wind up with heel Apollo out of this. I've not, you know, closed the door on that. I'm just kind of reading the tea leaves here, the way even on this show. You know, the moment that he chose Kevin Owens, I thought it might happen on this show. And there was that one spot during their match where he either got hit low. Yeah, like when an MMA fighter accidentally gets kneed in the balls or in the groin, sometimes he goes down, they give you 5 minutes to kind of get your bearings back. Are you okay? You ready to go? So they did something like that with Apollo, but then he just, you know, when he was saying, hey, I'm fine, he punched Owens in the face. It was almost like he was playing possum or something. Was he or wasn't he? We don't know, but it's not the sort of thing. It was kind of heelish in a way. It's not the sort of thing that you would normally see in a Apollo Crews match. So again, it just makes me think, that we may yet be going down a dark road with this guy turning to the evil side. And if he does he have it in him? Because I still look at this guy and I still think this guy's the quintessential babyface. Does he have a heel run in him? We may find out. The Viking Prophets and the Street Raiders, they went bowling this week. The Raiders ended up winning by a single point. I think it was like 131 to 130 or something like that, which is not a great score, by the way. If you know anything about bowling, I'm just saying. You know, when I used to bowl, I think my average was, I think I got it up to like 243 or something. It was very close to 250 out of 300. So I was not impressed. Although if I went bowling now, I'd probably get, 7 gutter balls. It's been a while. Be a little rusty. So both teams are now all knotted up in their head-to-head competitions. This was all comedy, as all of these skits have been. Tomorrow night they're having a decathlon. So I don't know what else to say about this. It's all for comedy. It's all for laughs. So some of the segments are entertaining. Some of them really are not. As a bowling guy, I found this mildly entertaining. Especially when the Street Profits said, "We want the smoke." And the guy who ran the bowling alley said, "Okay." And he turned the lights out and they played the lasers. I used to play laser bowling. What'd they call it? Glow bowling. I don't know if they did this all in bowling alleys across the country, but in Brooklyn back in the day at our local bowling alley at night, it became like a social thing. At like 11 o'clock at night or midnight, you go to the bowling alley on like a Friday night, let's say, and it would be glow bowl. And so all the lights would be out. They'd have these like lasers everywhere. There'd be smoke all over the lanes. You know, they'd have the bar open until 2 o'clock in the morning. You could drink, which is always fun to have people picking up these large bowling balls half fucking drunk. You talk about social distancing. Make sure you stay a little farther back than 6 feet when you have somebody with a bowling ball in their hand who's 3 sheets to the wind. That was always very entertaining. Although I was, at that stage, I don't even think I was allowed to drink. But you had other people who were. So anyway, those were the days. Who said bowling couldn't be fun? Shockingly, Rey Mysterio did not retire. They interviewed him from his home. He is unsure about his future. He could be cleared in a few weeks, he said, or I may never be cleared again. My eye is still healing. So basically, he is Shawn Michaels and his knee injury from 1997. Either it's career ending or he'll be back in a few weeks. We don't know. For Shawn, it took about 3 months, maybe 4. And he was back in tip-top shape. So much for that career-ending knee injury. So Ray's son Dominic, he showed up in the shot here via Skype or Zoom or whatever they were doing. He was very upset. He was very upset. He was threatening to deal with Rollins himself. Ray tried to calm him down. Ray said that he would never forgive Rollins for what he did. "Damn you, Seth Rollins," is what Ray Mysterio said. And Mysterio said, "Let's go," to Dominic. And he got up and walked away. And I'm just thinking, dude, if you're on Skype or Zoom, you just leave the feed? Like, what are you doing here? You want to go, but he leaves the camera on. He leaves the application running. And so Dominic stays. He just sits there. He lingers and he stares into the camera. And he tells Seth Rollins, "You're a man of scripture. An eye for an eye." So there it is. Dominic is involved. Dominic is now coming for revenge. You know, I floated his involvement last week, although I didn't float it as him turning on Ray, just because I don't know, a good way to get there. I guess Rollins is almost like this cult leader, so maybe he just finds a way to brainwash Dominic. But I know Ray really wants to tag with his son, so I just see that as being more of a likely scenario where he and Ray team up together to face Rollins and Murphy, or Rollins and Theory, or maybe it's Murphy and Theory, or who knows. Some combination. Maybe not, though. Maybe Seth can corrupt Ray's son. Get heel heat out. Well, I say get heel heat out of it, but there's no fans. See, there are some angles that they've done that would really only work in front of a crowd. I just think, I'm going to look back at this as just like a lost year. There were some good moments and good storyline payoffs and stuff, like Mandy and Otis at WrestleMania, stuff like that we're going to look back on and say, "God damn, I wish that was in front of an audience." That would have been one of those moments that they could play back, and maybe they still will, but it's not going to be the same. So we were not sure if they would air the Nia Jax-Kairi Sane match. We had reports last week of Kairi Sane getting a head injury. She was bleeding heavily. She was briefly knocked unconscious. You never like hearing about that. They did air the match. They did a hell of an editing job because we never saw any blood, although Kairi did post pictures on social media later of the cut on her head, all stitched up. It looked very gnarly. They edited all of that stuff out. You never saw any of that, including the match being stopped for a while. I mean, if she got knocked out legit, I'm surprised they even let her back in the ring, to be honest with you. And when they did resume, you could see Nia Jax drop the lightest leg drop you've ever seen, and then pinned her 1-2-3 just to get the match over with. Those reports of it supposedly, some people in the company made it very clear, wasn't Nia Jax's fault. As you'll see, it was not Nia's fault. Everyone's jumping on the hate Nia bandwagon. It wasn't her fault. And I said, well, okay, let's wait and see, right? I mean, who are you going to believe? You're going to believe some random anonymous source? Or you're going to believe your own lying eyes? I said, well, if they air it on TV, we'll see for ourselves whether or not it was her fault or not. Well, I watched the segment with my own two eyes. They kept the spot in where she whipped her into the ring steps. I saw it with my own two eyes, and that report turned out to be bullshit because it was 100% Nia Jax's fault. Nia was outside the ring. Kairi went for a baseball slide into her. Nia caught her, dragged her outside, rammed her face first into the ring apron, and then she launched Kairi forward towards the steel steps. She clearly never had her feet set, hit her head, got split open. Yes, I understand accidents happen, but if you watch that and you come to any conclusion other than it being Nia Jax's fault, you are fucking blind and you need to get your eyes checked. Nia was out for a year. She had double ACL surgery. That's not an easy thing. One ACL surgery is not easy to come back from, let alone two simultaneously. So she was out for a long time before she worked her way back. And she just seems to be no better than she was the last time we saw her. There's been no change. There's been no change. There's been no improvement. There's nothing. She is a great example of somebody who was called up way too soon and would have been much better off and would have been better served to spend more time in developmental. And I know others have said the same thing this week. All of a sudden, other people are getting on the whole bandwagon. Well, Nia should be sent to developmental. Well, guess fucking what? I said it here on the show a couple of years ago. I wish somebody was listening back then that she should have been sent back down to developmental for more training. That's what developmental at the time, maybe more so then than now, that's what it was for. But because she had a certain look, or maybe because she was born into a certain family, whatever it was, let's call her up. She's got a unique look. She's got a unique look. I walk by people on the street who have unique looks. That doesn't mean they belong in a wrestling ring. I was in Dwayne Reed the other day. There's some fucking creepy guy in the card section. He had a pretty unique look. Am I going to walk over to him and say, hey, you know what? You should be on Monday Night Raw this week. No, I'm not. What does that even mean? Got a unique look. If you're either ready or you're not. I thought the whole point of being down there was that you get these people to a point where they're ready. You give them some seasoning. You teach them the basics. And when they're ready, because the people on television should be the ones who are at an elite level. It should be a system where to get on television, to get one of those spots on Raw or SmackDown, right? We all know how costly television time can be. That should be reserved for the people who are at, you know, sort of this certain level, this elite level, and that's just not the case. Maybe they just look at the roster at the time and they say, well, you know, we're kind of light on the heel side in the women's division. Let's call up Nia Jax. Never should have been called up when she was in the first place. Now people are saying, oh, send her back down to developmental. Yeah, you think? Why are people only saying this now? She doesn't have to go very far. She's already in the PC with everybody else every single week. Just get her off television and let her work on her craft. I don't care what family she's from. I don't care what she looks like. Oh, she's the monster of the division. I don't care. She and everybody that she works with would be better off if she took some time away from television to work on her craft. Asuka at Backlash should not just beat Nia Jax. She should keep her in the Asuka lock for 5 minutes or longer. Even after their match is over, just keep that hold locked on. refused to let go. It's like Bob Backlund style, you know, the match with Bret Hart when he kept him in the chicken wing for like 9 minutes straight. And that's a painful hold. I can believe that's a painful hold. At Survivor Series back in 94, so it's kind of the same thing. She can, you know, do it as revenge for Kyrie. Then Nia goes away. And it serves another purpose, too, if they do it that way at Backlash, to show that Shayna Baszler is not the only dangerous submission threat on Monday Night Raw, which is another small way to build to the eventual match between Asuka and Shayna Baszler. Asuka has been used a lot in a more of a comedy spot recently. She can be very entertaining. This would be a good time for them to bring back some of that killer Asuka that we saw back in NXT. Speaking of Asuka, she wrestled Charlotte Flair, champion against champion. They had a very good match, or they were having a very good match, when Charlotte booted Asuka off the apron. Asuka's music started playing. And out walked Nia Jax. She's back again. This time she's wearing an Asuka mask. When she pulled it off, she had green Asuka's green, you know, face paint on under the eyes and all over the face. The bell rang, I guess, for the countout. I don't know that they ever announced it, but it had to be a countout. And Nia mowed down Asuka in the aisleway and pulled the mask off, threw it down on her, and walked off. Riveting. Riveting stuff. A shit finish to an otherwise very good match between Charlotte and Asuka. Lana, who has been having issues with MVP in her mind corrupting her husband Bobby, noted that Lashley did not want her at ringside for his matches, but he did not say anything about coming out for MVP's matches. And MVP just so happened to be in the main event this week wrestling Drew McIntyre. And so with about maybe 4 minutes left in the show, the match begins, and McIntyre beats him with a Claymore kick in about 2 minutes. And then immediately after, Lashley gets into the ring. Like, right when the bell rang and the match was over, Lashley gets into the ring. He puts McIntyre in the full Nelson. McIntyre's trying to fight out. He can't fight out. And then they just abruptly cut away and go off the air. And they cut to the next show, which was kind of strange considering this was a taped show. But, you know, hey, at least we didn't get the standard drawn-out, mean, you know, make a mean face into the camera. And let's linger on the person for an abnormal, very uncomfortable length of time. That's kind of one of those WWE production trademarks. At least we didn't have that. I'll take what good wrestling I can get with Rollins and Black, Charlotte and Asuka, and the NXT folks being in the crowd behind the plexiglass. It does help a little bit. But the rest of this show was just a terrible slog to sit through. It's just a terrible slog to sit through. You may have noticed, after coming back, being away for several months due to injury, coming back and getting a win over Akira Tozawa a few weeks ago, you may have noticed, or maybe not, that Jinder Mahal has disappeared again. He is nowhere to be found, and that is because Jinder Mahal is once again back on the shelf. He posted on Instagram that he was having some knee issues and he had to go back under the knife for more knee surgery. I can't say that I had a lot of interest in seeing him challenge for the WWE title again, because I didn't. But he did have this natural program there for the taking with Drew McIntyre, given their history in 3MB. And now he is out hurt again. So for him, it sucks. But injury presents opportunity. And with Jinder going down, it appears that this move may be linked to him going down. They are moving Dominik Dijakovic over to the Monday Night Raw brand, possibly as soon as tomorrow night. You know, Dijakovic, Donovan Dijak, he's tall, he can go in the ring, he's a good wrestler. I think he'll do well. Right, it goes back to that size issue I was talking about earlier. Same for Keith Lee. When Keith Lee eventually gets the call to go to Raw or to go to SmackDown, I think he'll do well too. With WWE having just fired Chris DeJoseph from the writing team on SmackDown, DeJoseph used to work for the company many years ago as a writer, and he would also make cameos on TV. He was the one who played Big Dick Johnson. Then he went on to be the head writer for Lucha Underground, I believe for all four seasons, and you know how much I love Lucha Underground. Well, he signed with MLW late last year. And then about a month later, he left to go take a job with WWE. So he didn't spend very many days working for MLW before he jumped back to WWE. That was in December. He was actually just given a promotion within the last few weeks. And he was one of the lead writers on the show before Vince McMahon fired him, supposedly for something he said. I don't know what the infraction was or what it was that he may have said, but it was enough to get him fired. And so WWE is now looking for a new head writer for SmackDown. They have a listing for the position on their careers page. I checked it a couple of days ago. Maybe it's changed since then, but when I checked it, there were exactly zero qualifications listed for the position. Just that the position was open and you can apply. No qualifications listed to be the head writer for SmackDown. That explains a lot. So, if you ever wanted to be the head writer for SmackDown, now's your chance. That's certainly not a job I want, but if you are interested, then go ahead and apply. Kurt Angle. He gave an interview this week, and he revealed that he was offered the role of Matt Riddle's manager on SmackDown, and that he turned it down because he's trying to launch his own business. I think it's some kind of supplement or nutritional type business. He wants to see it succeed. He has to dedicate time to making it a success, and so he just felt that it would take up too much of his time and he couldn't do it. But he figured the idea behind it probably would have been that he would manage Riddle and that the two of them would eventually go on to have a match. Because in wrestling, there is no such thing as a final match. Even though we saw Kurt Angle lose, look, if I lost to Baron Corbin at WrestleMania, I'd come back too. I'd come back for the fucking finger poke of doom. Just so I didn't have to retire knowing that Baron Corbin was my final opponent in a very uneventful match at WrestleMania. But see, the Kurt Angle of like, even 10 years ago, 10 years ago he was still kind of broken down, but like 10 years ago, the Kurt Angle of 15 years ago against Matt Riddle would have been an incredible match. But the Kurt Angle of today, I mean, for God's sakes, it pains me to watch the guy walk. He walks with a hunch. He can't even stand up straight. We don't need to be seeing that. Angle as Riddle's manager, though, what that tells me is that they really do have high hopes for Matt Riddle. I don't think they would put Kurt Angle as a manager, you know, for just anyone. I take that as a good sign. Now, I don't think they would put Kurt Angle with just anybody given his stature if they were just going to bury the guy or not do anything with the guy or quickly lose interest in the guy. So that's a good sign. I only wish they had that same confidence, though, in Chad Gable and offered Angle the spot of being Gable's manager. That's what I would like to see. Because I don't think Riddle needs him. In fact, I know he doesn't. But imagine, you know, Angle and Gable, and this goes back to when they did the thing with Angle and Jason Jordan, and a lot of people, myself included, felt that Gable would have been the better fit for that spot, you know, the son of Kurt Angle. Because there are a lot of similarities between them and certainly, they certainly look more alike, I would say. But, like, I think about what they could do with Angle in the position as being Gable's manager, right? I mean, he approaches him, let's say, in the back. I've thought about this. He approaches him one day in the back after a frustrating string of losses. And he just laces into him. He just berates him over his lack of confidence. You're an Olympian, damn it. What's the matter with you? You're Chad freaking Gable. What the hell are you wearing? He mocks his attire. He gets him to drop the Space Jam outfit and the Shorty G name. And then we're off to the races with a renewed Chad Gable push with Kurt Angle as something of a coach. I wouldn't even call him a manager. He would be like his coach. Like Arn Anderson is Cody's coach in AEW. Only here you would have two Olympic wrestlers, so the coach label kind of works better. That's a role that I could see Kurt Angle being and that I think he would do well in, and it would benefit the person that he is put with. Riddle does not need a manager. I don't look at Matt Riddle and think, boy, this guy needs somebody to talk for him. I know not everybody is a Matt Riddle fan, and, you know, you listen to him speak, and, you know, he just has a very distinct voice, I guess you would say. But he does not need somebody to do the talking for him. And he even said as much. Riddle did an interview this week. He was asked about it. He said, well, I heard that they wanted Kurt to be my manager, and Kurt said he couldn't do it because he was busy. But he said, look, I love Kurt, but I don't think I need somebody doing the talking for me. I don't need Kurt Angle. And he's right. He doesn't. Although managers can do more than just talk for their clients. It's not just about talking. Riddle does not need a manager. Jeff Hardy gave his version of what happened on TV this week. What happened the previous week on SmackDown. He said that when he arrived at the PC, something hit him over the back of the head. And the next thing he knew, he reeked of alcohol and he was being handcuffed. And he started to question himself, did I really do this? Have I let down my wife and kids again, my two daughters? But then he went to the police station and he passed all of his sobriety tests. And a witness showed up and claimed that they saw somebody with red hair and a red beard running from the car, the rental car. Sheamus, of course, just happens to fit that description. So does Murphy, by the way, and Aleister Black. And probably a few other people who work in that company. This sounds like a very shoddy investigation if that's all the evidence they have to go on. I can't believe they didn't get the hacker involved here. I thought for sure the hacker would have some kind of involvement here. Maybe they still will. Maybe in the weeks to come there'll be some kind of video that reveals it wasn't Sheamus. Maybe there's some big swerve. Maybe it was Ali and Ali was wearing a red wig and a red beard and he's just trying to get back on TV. If you read Ali's tweets, you know, unless he's just working everybody, he doesn't seem very happy about the fact that he has been off television now doing nothing for months. You know, we're all just kind of assuming that it's him because of the symbol on the hand. And, you know, he's not being used. He's not injured at the moment. So who else could the hacker be? Well, you know what? If they want to swerve everybody, it could be somebody else that we're not thinking of. But maybe it is Ali and he was disguised as Sheamus. And then he goes on to feud next with Jeff Hardy. Who knows? But Ali is getting very restless, and he's clearly, if you read his tweets, he's very upset that he's just sitting on his ass. He's ready to go to work, and they're just not using him, and they're not doing anything with him. And he's a talented guy. They should be doing something with him. That's why I hope he is part of this whole hacker thing, because if not him, then, you know, then who? You know, maybe it was CM Punk wearing a disguise, since everybody seems to think CM Punk is coming back. They just can't give up the ghost on that one. You know, CM Punk and Jeff Hardy have a history. Maybe CM Punk dressed up in a disguise. Wouldn't be the first time he showed up to a wrestling show with a disguise on. The Sheamus came out. He said Jeff was in denial. He says Jeff's not a man. He's just a junkie. He said you don't have to worry about letting your wife and daughters down because they're used to it. He kind of hesitated before he even said. It almost reminded me of, you know, the whole Eddie's in Hell thing with Randy Orton. And Randy Orton and Rey Mysterio did not want to have any part of that. But that was, they were told, this is what you got to do. And there have been other things over the years. Paige made a comment years ago on TV about Charlotte's brother who passed away. Which was really fucking gross and tasteless. And you could tell, like, she kind of hesitated. Like, even she did not want to say it. But then she went and said it anyway, and everybody just cringed at the line. Sheamus kind of hesitated here, too. I don't know if it was by design or if he also just was like, what the hell am I doing here? But, I said last week, I know why they're doing this. I figured it was going to be, it seemed obvious that it was going to be a swerve. Jeff is not really a drunk again and all this stuff. But, yes, is it a tasteless angle? No, it is not a tasteless angle at all. It is actually very classless. It actually is very classless, but, you know, was Jeff okay with it? Who knows? I said last week, if he wasn't, and they forced him or he felt coerced into doing this, then this company is fucking disgusting. But it played out exactly the way that I figured it would, where Sheamus is revealed to be the man behind it, and Jeff passed all of his tests, and Jeff is still, you know, Jeff is still cool, everybody, and Sheamus is just being a heel, he's being a dick. Jeff came after him and Sheamus threw him into the plexiglass boards on either side of the rampway and broke the boards. Now, it might have made for a good visual and it sounded cool, but it kind of defeats the whole purpose of having plexiglass, right? I mean, let's not forget the reason the plexiglass is up. There's a fucking pandemic. Oh, let's throw the guy into the plexiglass and just break it. Although, again, if everybody is being tested, that would include the people in the audience. So, again, this is more, I think, just for kind of seeing how it looks on TV and getting used to how things are going to be once they start running buildings again. But just, you know, if they start doing that shit, let's say they get 25% capacity and fans start to come back into some of these buildings, and they do shit like this where they break the boards, then what's the fucking point of having the boards? The boards have to be intact. This is not anything that is negotiable. I mean, if you think it's a safety risk, you can't be throwing people into the boards. I know it's very tempting, but you can't be doing that. So the two of them are going to have a match at Backlash. No surprise there. They had Otis and Mandy walking in the back together when they came across a chair. King Corbin, I guess, had left his robe and he had left his crown sitting on the chair. Maybe he went to go to the bathroom and, you know, wherever he was. He was nowhere to be found, and so Otis decided to steal the crown. And then we see Corbin come back. He flips out. Where is my crown? Who took my crown? This led to their scheduled match where Otis won when Corbin hit him with a chair for the disqualification. All of this sucked. Everything about this sucked. You know, I'm watching Baron Corbin, a grown man, lose his mind because somebody stole his plastic crown. If you're 9 years old, then maybe you found this entertaining. This was a Sesame Street angle. Not for me. Lacey Evans and Sonya Deville, they had another match this week. And I know I didn't talk about it last week. I didn't really have a whole lot to say about it. I'm not going segment by segment on these shows. I'm just kind of going through the stuff that I feel is important to talk about. But I thought their first match was fine. This one was good until the distraction finish where Mandy popped up on the Tron, distracted Sonya, turned, boom, woman's right, down she goes. Lacey Evans picks up the win. Lacey and Sonya do have some pretty decent chemistry together. May not be the last time we see them work against each other. I think Sonya's been great. So this was fine. Throughout the show, we got a series of segments with Miz and Morrison. From inside of a white van parked outside the building in the parking lot. Playing various pranks. They're like watching on camera. It's like a prank show. Playing various pranks on Braun Strowman. This is how they are promoting their WWE Universal Championship match at Backlash. First, Braun's protein shake exploded and it went all over him. And he got very angry and he walked off. Then, as he was being interviewed by Kayla Braxton, green goo fell from the ceiling like this was a Nickelodeon show, only it missed Braun. It fell on Kayla. Then later on, they got out of the van. They found Braun's car in the parking lot and they destroyed it. They took a baseball bat to the windshield. When Braun found his car, he freaked out, and a security guard told him, hey, Miz and Morrison, they're hiding out in that van over there. they're right over there. And Braun angrily, you know how this went. Braun angrily, get out of the van. They're not getting out of the van. So he does his feat of strength and all the different camera cuts that we had here. And he flipped the van over onto its side with Miz and Morrison inside. This, again, ladies and gentlemen, is your build to your Universal Championship match at Backlash in what could very well be the worst wrestling match ever. How come they don't use that tagline? They should have dumped dog shit on Braun's head because that's what this was as far as getting me interested in their match at the pay-per-view. So that's Nickelodeon angle or Sesame Street angle number two on this show. We have more short jokes directed at Chad Gable because I guess that's his whole gimmick now. He's short. Let's point and mock him. Oh, he's short. And he'll get wins over people like Mojo Rawley and it won't mean jack shit because who gives a fuck if you beat Mojo Rawley? How is that getting you over? How is that getting him over? So Mojo's in the back. He's making fun of him. He's making short jokes. Mojo Rawley, by the way. And look, I've met Mojo before. He's a cool guy. I don't have anything against him personally. But Mojo Rawley, the luckiest man in the world that his boy Gronk waited until late April to rejoin the NFL. After all of the talent releases that we saw in this company in the month of April had already taken place. He's the luckiest man in the world because if Gronk had left the company earlier, if he had gone back to the NFL even like a month earlier, there is a very good chance that Mojo Rawley would be on the unemployment line like all of those people are. Cesaro and Nakamura showed up. They all attacked Gable. New Day rushes over to help him, and of course, that leads to a six-man tag. Raleigh hit his hyperdrive move on Gable for a near fall. Big E with the blind tag. Big ending to Mojo, wins it for the babyfaces. Gable held Cesaro and Nakamura at bay, so it's a win for the babyfaces. But this whole look, it's in the guy's name. You know, I mean, so this is just how it's going to be. This is how he has now been pigeonholed. There are people in the company shorter than he is. How come wrestlers don't go up to them and make fun of them? That never made any sense to me. They pick this guy specifically, right? There are people on the roster who are as short or shorter than he is. They don't get bullied on TV. Only this guy does, because it's his gimmick. Daniel Bryan and AJ Styles, they meet this Friday in the finals to crown a new Intercontinental Champion, which has already been taped, and I don't know the outcome or anything, but it was said to be a fantastic match, as I'm sure it was. But first, they had a face-to-face in the ring. Bryan admitted they have very different worldviews. We won't get into that, although they kind of did on that Talking Smack once, where he kind of mocked him for the whole Flat Earth thing. AJ insists he's not a Flat Earther, he's just asking questions. He's just asking, what if? What if? Bryan talked about wanting to defend the title every week against different opponents, whereas AJ, he was content to just take a bye into the finals and kind of coast. Styles says, I don't give handouts to people. He called Drew Gulak another one of these handouts. He decided to give Gulak an opportunity. He challenged Drew Gulak to a match. Drew Gulak, who has re-signed with the company. Gulak went on to win the match with a shock pin. He reversed the Styles Clash attempt into a roll-up. It wasn't too much of a surprise if you really kind of paid attention to the commentary, which I try not to do on a lot of these shows. But a lot of times they'll kind of just give these finishes away, just something they say. But I liked it. And we have new women's tag team champions. Sasha Banks and Bayley have regained the titles. They beat Alexa Bliss and Nikki Cross in a surprise. I did not see that finish coming, but I liked it. I liked it. They also furthered the story between Sasha and Bayley. By no means does them winning the titles mean that all is well between the two of them. Bayley got taken out by a tornado DDT on the floor at one point. Sasha went to go reach for the tag. Nobody was there because Bayley was down on the other side of the ring. So that was kind of problem number one. Then later, Sasha got Nikki Cross in the bank statement, but Bayley had made the blind tag. And so she came in, she shoved Sasha off. She put Nikki in the bank statement, and she was kicking at Sasha. Get out of the ring. And so Sasha was not very happy about that at all. She ended up dragging Bayley back over to the ropes so that she can make a tag. Nikki tried to roll up Sasha. Sasha reversed into a crucifix, and just like that, we have new women's tag team champions. Bayley was fantastic in her celebration. She was acting like she could barely hold up both belts. It's so much gold, it's so heavy, she could barely hold the two belts up. Now she's Bayley two belts. She's got two belts now. She was laying on the announce desk, mocking Michael Cole. Backstage, when the show was over, the two of them laid on the floor and started mock crying to make fun of the reports of them laying on the floor last year after WrestleMania crying about their title loss. Bayley has quickly become my favorite person to watch on SmackDown. Them winning the titles was unexpected, but it allows them to draw things out a little bit longer, you know, between the two of them. I still think SummerSlam is the time to do the match. I've heard these reports that Vince McMahon has decided that he wants to just extend it indefinitely until they can get people back in the buildings, and so we may not get a Sasha Bayley match until the end of the year or early next year. Who knows? You can only extend things out for so long. How long are you going to wait? How long are you going to drag this out for? SummerSlam is still 2 months away, 2.5 months away. That's you know, a decent amount of time. I still feel like that would be the place to do it, the first match anyway. Things are starting to slowly reopen. They may yet be able to have fans at SummerSlam this year. It may only be at 25% capacity, but it's possible. It is possible, although probably not in Boston. But I thought the match was good, the finish was great, and the celebration was fantastic. I enjoyed this. So let's talk a little bit here about AEW and FTR. FTR, Dash and Dawson, now, well, obviously, they're not Dash and Dawson anymore, but they made their debut on Dynamite last week. They had their first sit-down this past week, sit-down interview on TV with Tony Schiavone, who was interviewing them in a building lobby somewhere. And I thought it was good in that they at least establish why they're here. They establish the issues, you know, that they have with, you know, other teams being called the greatest in the world and teasing out the issue with them and the Bucks. But they also gave a much more interesting interview than the one on TV to Jim Cornette, who is a favorite of theirs, and Cornette is a favorite of them. Mutual admiration society between the two sides. Cornette had FTR on his podcast this past week. If you heard the interview that they gave on Talk is Jericho, not much in the way of new information, really, as far as their unhappiness in WWE and getting their release. I mean, there was a lot of overlap there, but they told the story of Triple H agreeing at one point to grant them their release when they first asked for their release. He's like, all right, if you guys want your release, I'll give you your release. And then the very next day, he turned around and said, I'm not going to give you your release, because he had time to think about it, and I think you guys have a lot to contribute. And so they did not initially get their release. But Scott Dawson, again, I guess I still call him Scott Dawson. I'm not used to Dax Harwood yet, so I'm still going to call him Scott Dawson. He did tell one story when Cornette asked what the percentages of guys who study old tape and such, students of the game, right? Students of history. How many people in the company do that sort of thing? He told a story about walking one day into the PC, and they had brought in Ricky Morton. They brought Ricky Morton in, I guess, as a guest trainer. And how he found Ricky Morton, one of the greatest wrestler, one of the greatest tag team wrestlers, tag team specialists of all time, over by one of the rings in the PC, all by himself. Not one person around him, not one person approaching him, not one person asking him questions. Nobody around him. And he got hot about it. He was angry. He was upset. Dawson walked into the office where Matt Bloom was, the head trainer, and he's like, what the fuck? He was beside himself. And he said Bloom agreed, and he couldn't believe it. And he told Dawson, he goes, hey, if you want to say something, the floor is yours. And so he called a meeting of all the talents in the Performance Center, and Dawson says he just laced into them. He laced into them. He got all emotional and started crying, and he was giving this impassioned speech to all of these wrestlers. He goes, you have Ricky effing Morton standing right there. There were guys at the time who were in the middle of a tag team class. He goes, you're in tag team class? You've got one of the greatest tag team wrestlers of all time standing there basically with his thumb up his ass, and nobody is asking him questions. Nobody's picking his brain. Nobody's talking to him. And he said, he goes, he'll bet that a lot of people who were in the PC that day never even watched a Ricky Morton match. They probably never even knew who he was. They had no idea who the man was. And that was kind of a telling story. But the bigger news coming out of this interview were their comments about the Young Bucks and their, you know, heat with them and their heat with Cody over comments that Cody made on a podcast a few years ago with Sam Roberts. Now, let me just say, I can believe that the Cody comments did bother them. I can believe the Cody comments at the time did rub them the wrong way. But I don't believe there is any heat with the Young Bucks. I think, you know, they did a very good job in this interview with Cornette of blending reality with fiction. They were working their asses off during this interview, and they were very convincing. They were very convincing in trying to make people believe that they might shoot on the Young Bucks when they finally do meet in the ring, and that we haven't signed any contract yet with Tony Khan. We're working off a short-term handshake agreement. I don't buy that for a second. But it does make for a good story. So when I talk about these comments, you got to think about them in that context. You might believe them, you might not believe them. You got to take them with a grain of salt when you listen to them. But they said that their issue with Cody was with him telling Sam Roberts that the Revival, you know, I guess Sam Roberts must have asked him, hey, between the Revival and the Young Bucks, who do you think is the greatest tag team in the world today? And Cody at the time said that he felt the Bucks were the best tag team in the world, 100%. Which, I mean, you would expect him to say for obvious reasons. But he said for the Revival, and this is what got the Revival supposedly upset, he made comments to the effect, and I'm paraphrasing here, but he said that the Revival, who were having great matches at the time in NXT, I mean, they were having great matches with American Alpha and I think Gargano and Ciampa. I mean, they were on a roll in NXT and those big takeover matches. And Cody said, you know, these guys know, I would hope they're going out there and having great matches because these guys know a month in advance who they're going to be wrestling. And they go out and they practice their match. They have a month to go out and practice their match at the Performance Center. Whereas the Young Bucks may sometimes get to a show and they may find out 2 hours beforehand, you know, who they're going to wrestle, and they're going to go out there and still tear it up. And FTR found this offensive because never in their lives, Dawson said, have they practiced a wrestling match. And they were very offended when they heard that. And that I can believe. I can believe that that did bother them. Now they're just sort of playing it up. But that I can believe. Because that is, you know, that is kind of a shitty thing to say if you think about it. And Cornette went off on it too. He kind of cut a promo of his own. I can see that as being viewed as disrespectful. Kind of a shitty thing to say. Their heat with the Bucks, they claim, stems from the fact that in 2016... when they started doing the whole, you know, fuck the Revival stuff and name-dropping them, they were working their own angle. Basically, that they were working their own angle. They never told FTR, they never got their consent, or they never asked for their permission. Oh, hey guys, listen, we're gonna do this, and we're gonna get the marks talking and all this stuff. Like, none of that. They just went and did it. And they found that very disrespectful. And so they teased in this interview here that when they finally do get into the ring with the Bucks, and that they've already told Tony Khan this, like, you know, there's no telling what might happen here. They were teasing that it might be a little more snug. They might shoot on them, basically, is what they were saying. And they claimed that not only did they tell this to Tony Khan, but that Khan liked the idea. He said, oh, that'd be great. They claim they have no contract. They're still negotiating on a deal. They may wind up signing one, but they don't currently have one. That I don't buy. But they are very convincing when they talk about this stuff, you know, like the heat with the Bucks. It is a smart way to build heat for the eventual match. You know, think about the audience that AEW caters to. It is a lot of these so-called, you know, smart fans and fans who are into a certain style. And so for them, it's smart to let these guys go on. You know, just the fact that they went on Cornette's podcast, I'm sure, is going to rub a lot of people in that company, including the Bucks, the wrong way, you know, and other people that Cornette has insulted viciously on his podcast. And I'm not just talking about, you know, Kenny Olivier, and, you know, we all know his thoughts on Kenny Omega and, you know, Balding Buck and Road Warrior Buck, I think he calls him. I can never figure out which is which, like who's supposed to be Balding Buck and who's Road Warrior Buck. But, you know, Cornette, he does review AEW, I guess, on his podcast. I know he reviewed the whole Stadium Stampede thing and tore it to shreds. And I don't doubt that he is, in a way, playing it up, but that he also genuinely doesn't like that style of wrestling. And so he constantly is shitting on the product and shitting on some of the, and saying very, in some cases, ridiculously offensive things about some of the talents on the roster. And so I can't imagine even these guys getting all buddy-buddy on his podcast, you know, makes them very happy. But look, you know, there's not, if they want to go on the podcast and talk to Cornette, that's their prerogative. They have the right to do that. They have the right to do that. But this kind of leads into the next idea, which is the idea of Cornette possibly doing something with AEW or being brought in even just for a match as a manager for FTR, which they did address that as well. But just to go back for a second to the whole Bucks FTR thing, and you know, my belief that it is smart to kind of build it up this way, I think it is smart. They also have to be careful. This is not, and the Bucks do the whole being the elite thing, and there's a lot of funny skits and stuff, and you know, FTR skywriting in the sky and stuff, and a lot of it is played up for laughs, and a lot of it is played up for comedy. I don't think that this is a program, I don't think that this is a feud that should be played up for jokes at all. I think you got to leave the funny stuff out of this. No special effects, no dream sequences like we got with Matt versus Nick, right, in their match on being the Elite 200. You got to leave that shit at the door. If you want people to really buy into this as something real, you want people to buy into the idea, oh, there's real heat here, we might shoot, all of this stuff, all the funny ha-ha bullshit has to be kept out of this. So that's one of the things, in my opinion, that they have to do. You want to play it up as legit, make the shot stiff, make it feel like a real fight between these two teams, like they really have something to prove as far as who the best tag team in the world is. But there was definitely a blend of reality and fiction going on in this interview. And they did at the very end, again, tease the idea that maybe Cornette, hey, you know what would be, and FTR would love for Cornette to manage them. And they're the ones who brought up the idea. They said, you know what would be even better if we had you in our corner, you know, for our matches. And Cornette joked, he said, well, you know, if they come close by, if they're between like this state and this state, you know, he basically was insinuating that he would be open to it. He would be open to the idea. That too will never happen. No way. No way would AEW, I think, even entertain the idea of that happening. And it really is just not worth the potential damage that it would cause with their own talent. I mean, forget the fans. With their own talent. There are talent that work in that company who have been attacked verbally by Jim Cornette, and maybe others who haven't been, but who have heard some of the things that he has said about some of the people who work in the company, whether it be a Marco Stunt or a Nyla Rose or a Sunny Kiss or whoever. And I just think that it would be a real issue for Tony Khan in terms of the trust of the locker room and the people who work for him, if it ever was to get to that point where they actually brought Cornette into that locker room, even just one time. I'm not going to tell you that it wouldn't be entertaining. I'm not going to tell you that it wouldn't, I think it wouldn't get tremendous heat. As a promoter, it's the sort of thing you kind of salivate over, the idea of it. But I just think that the things that he has said and continues to say and everything, unless you believe that everything he says is bullshit and you don't believe a word he says, and I do think he actually has that level of hatred for the product. He just does not like the product and some of the people who work for that company. I just think you're inviting way too much trouble than you need to have if you're Tony Khan by even entertaining the idea of bringing Jim Cornette in for any kind of angle or match in this company. So it's nice to talk about, but no, I don't see that happening. I'm sure the Revival would love it, but I don't see that happening. But as far as the FTR Bucks feud, like I said, smart way to build it up, but keep the funny stuff and the skits and all of that. Keep it out. You really want people to believe that this is quote unquote real, that this stems from real heat and you don't know what's going to happen? You got to keep the funny stuff out of it. You got to keep all that stuff, you know, the Matt Hardy type stuff, the drones and the teleportation and all that has to be kept out. And just let these two teams go at it, because this is a match that people have been talking about for a very long time. People throw around the dream match label. You know, to me, I don't really have any realistic dream matches anymore. Maybe at one time, you know, guys have retired since then and stuff. I can't say that I have what's my dream match. My dream matches involve matches that literally cannot happen anymore. You know, Kurt Angle against Bret Hart, that's a dream match. Bret Hart and Owen Hart against Kurt Angle and Chris Benoit at one time, that would have been a dream match. These are matches that simply are not possible anymore. Realistically, I can't think of any that I have, but look, I think the Bucks and FTR, because it has been built up for so many years, and I'm sure these two teams have been dying to work with each other, I think when they finally meet, you know, it might be better than even the Kenny Omega Hangman Page match that they had with the Bucks, which a lot of people think is one of the all-time great tag team matches. It was an excellent match, you know, that we saw at Revolution. And this has the potential to top even that, you know. And I hope when the time comes, they go out there and they tear the house down. And it would be nice if they had fans in the building when they did it. I wouldn't do the match anytime before All Out, the first match. Keep the comedy out. Play it up as real. That's the way to go. Dynamite this Wednesday is a live show featuring the return of Chris Jericho to the announce desk. FTR will make their in-ring debut against The Butcher and The Blade. Colt Cabana, who is either about to join the Dark Order or feud with them, or maybe feud with them and then join. That's what they're teasing. He takes on Sammy Guevara, so Sammy might actually finally win a match, because Colt Cabana has been on something of a losing streak, or at least he's not been able to kind of win the big one, and he's been very down about it. That's part of why he's now being recruited by the Dark Order, because that's what the Dark Order is. They just recruit losers. That's what they do. So Sammy Guevara might actually get a rare win on Dynamite this Wednesday Jake Hager, Santana, and Ortiz of the Inner Circle take on Best Friends and the Baddest Man on the Planet, Orange Cassidy. And Cody defends the TNT title against Marquen of Private Party. Fyter Fest. Fyter Fest now has a date. All we knew before was that it was going to take place sometime this summer. Well, now we know it actually has not just one date, it's got two. July 1st and July 8th, free on TNT. Fyter Fest will be two parts this year, like WrestleMania. Too big for one night. Special episodes of Dynamite. Basically like themed episodes, kind of Dynamite. July 1st is going to be airing live. July 8th will be taped. They're taping that show the next night on July 2nd. All AEW titles will be defended at Fyter Fest. Jon Moxley defends against Brian Cage. Kenny Omega and Hangman Page defend their AEW tag team titles against Best Friends. And they have yet to announce the women's title match or the TNT title match, but they will be defended as well. And last but not least here, the AEW show in Newark, originally scheduled for Newark, New Jersey, back in March. That was going to be the big blood and guts show. It had been postponed to next month. I know people were hoping maybe they'd get it in by then. Those people were delusional if they actually believed that was going to happen. And to no surprise, it has now been postponed a second time, this time to February 21st of next year. And I don't know if that means they're going to hold off on Blood and Guts until next year, or if they're going to try to get it in before the year is out. My understanding is that Tony Khan, they really want to save Blood and Guts for Newark. So if that's the case, we may end up with a year-long delay. Like a lot of movies, right? A lot of movies were scheduled to come out this year that have been pushed back by a year. Blood and Guts may be the same way if they insist on doing it in Newark. But I can understand why. They were expecting upwards of maybe 14,000 people for that show. If I was going to have 14,000 people at one of my biggest shows of all time, I'd want to save a special match for those people too. So let's take a few mailbag questions. If you have a question, you can always email me, thesolemonster at gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. I'm going to try to get to more of these as the weeks go on. I know I've not had as much time as I would like for it, so we'll try to work more of these in. Tom from New York. I'm a week behind on SmackDown, and I saw Nikki Cross speaking Adam Sandler gibberish, and it reminds me that there is too much comedy in wrestling today. WWE has Otis, New Day, R-Truth, Asuka, Nikki Cross, Matt Riddle, and that horrible shit show called Money in the Bank. AEW has comedic and goofy characters like Broken Matt, Marco Stunt, and Orange Cassidy. I'm not saying comedy is bad. Not shitting on any of the performers either. R-Truth, in my opinion, is a genius. Just saying, let's look back to the 80s when wrestling was at its best, in my opinion. You had guys like Hogan, Savage, Steamboat, Flair, Andre, Bundy, DiBiase, and Piper that were offset from one or two goofy comedic characters like George the Animal Steel. It seemed like a better balance. Well, I mean, to be fair, there were more than just a couple of comedic characters back then. I mean, if you look at the WWF roster, even in the... forget the early 90s, where you got fucking Repo Man and, you know... Even the Mountie. I mean, look, the Mountie is one of the... I like the Mountie, actually. I thought the Mountie was very entertaining and... But, you know, even he, like, they would play up comedy with him sometimes. In the 80s, they had some ridiculous characters. But yes, it was a very different time. I agree that I think an over-reliance on comedy is very bad for wrestling. I mean, look, it goes to what I was just talking about earlier. I was reviewing SmackDown, and I'm talking about Braun Strowman against Miz and Morrison. Now, that's a, you know, to have that as your Universal title match is terrible to begin with. But look at how they were promoting the match this past week. Right? The whole concept of building this big championship match for the pay-per-view was to have Miz and Morrison acting like a couple of high school kids playing practical jokes and pranks on Braun Strowman throughout the entire show. And that's just one example. I mean, that's not how I would promote my WWE title or Universal title match. You know, Money in the Bank was kind of an exception where it's your pay-per-view main event and it was played up for comedy. I appreciated the fact that they tried to think outside the box and do something different. And I was one of those people who enjoyed, you know, you call it a shit show. I enjoyed Money in the Bank for what it was. It's not going to be like that every year. They tried something different. It's not going to be everyone's cup of tea. I understand that. But you're right. They have a lot of comedy acts. They have a lot of comedy in general on these shows. Some of it is okay. You don't want to lean too heavily into it. AEW, do they do too much of it? I don't know if they do too much of it. Obviously, Orange Cassidy is one of those kind of special gimmicks that is played up for comedy. Marco Stunt, I don't know that it's played up for comedy. I think it's just a matter of, you know, he's so small and so tiny that people are just offended by him. you know, that's because he is. I mean, not many people who are on USA or TNT, you know, in one of the big promotions, are as small as Marco Stunt. I was just talking about Adam Cole earlier. Marco Stunt makes Adam Cole, you know, look like Adam Bomb. Okay, so yes, I agree in that you don't want to have too much comedy. And if you are a new fan or a lapsed fan trying to get back into wrestling and all you see is Nikki Cross shouting gibberish and Asuka, who used to be anyway, this killer, shouting gibberish and R-Truth doing his goofy 24/7 stuff and the New Day throwing pancakes out to the, you know, no fans in the crowd and you know, some of the other stuff that they'll do, you would say, well, why am I supposed to take any of this seriously? Okay, this, you know, R-Truth is very entertaining, but why does everything have to be based in comedy? You know, I can't not look at King Corbin and not laugh. How am I supposed to take somebody like that seriously? You know, and he's one of the more pushed performers on the brand. Too much comedy is a terrible thing. You don't want to rely too much on it. You have to strike the right balance. Tom is right. In that respect, Tom is right. You got to strike the right balance. Mike from Placenta, California. Ew. Placentia, California. How are you going to name a city like that? That's the first thing anybody's going to think of when they read that. That is gross. Which is appropriate because his question is about Tammy Sitch. What are your thoughts on Tammy Sitch's tweets and outbursts on social media this week? I don't have anything to say about her tweets. Frankly, I don't even care to give her the publicity, which is what she wants. She has some kind of page, I'm not going to say what it is, that she wants people to, you know, to pay for and stuff. And it's not worth it. It's not worth it to even plug her name. It's not worth it to plug anything she's doing. I did see the tweets. I don't follow her, but I did see the tweets. And look, her words speak for themselves. I'm sure in a few weeks or in a few months, there's going to be another Tammy Sitch arrest that I'm going to have to report on here on the podcast. Outside of that, she is a disgusting human being who does not deserve attention. That's my thoughts on Tammy Sitch. Chandler from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. What is the story behind the heat between Vader and Stevie Ray? Is it true they shot on each other once on pay-per-view and that they fought when they got back to the dressing room? What was the issue between them? No, they didn't fight in the locker room, but Stevie Ray almost killed Vader. Vader had no idea, I don't know if he ever knew, how close he came to dying that night. Now, Stevie's told the story on his podcast. I remember seeing the clip on YouTube sometime in the last few years. If you go on the WWE Network, you can bring up the incident. It was Battle Bowl. If you remember, WCW did this Battle Bowl tag team concept for a few years. It was like a tag team tournament back in the 90s where partners would be paired up at random. So totally randomized teams. They had this lethal lottery, they called it. I think they only had one like standalone Battle Bowl pay-per-view, I think. The others were just incorporated into one of the other shows. But this would have been 93 or 94. 93 Vader, I have to say, 93 Vader was awesome. Big Van Vader in 1992, 1993, and like as the champion in those matches that he had with Sting and Cactus Jack and Ric Flair, like that was Vader at his peak right there. But anyway, it was somewhere in 93 or 94, that Battle Bowl, and it was the very first match of the night. Vader was paired off with Cactus Jack. And Stevie Ray was paired off with someone else. It was not Booker T. I don't remember who it was. There was a spot in the match where Stevie is in the ring with Cactus. And Vader, back then, obviously, Vader used to just kill dudes. I mean, he would kill them. Those body blows and those punches were vicious. I would not want to be in the ring with Big Van Vader. It probably was not a good night for you if you found yourself in the ring with Big Van Vader. But Stevie is watching Vader just beat on his partner, beat on this poor guy, and he's just thinking to himself, like, what the hell is this guy's problem? Like, whoever Stevie's partner was getting the shit beaten out of him, I guess, at one point by Vader. So now Stevie gets in the ring with Cactus. And Vader is taking his time, you know, leaving the ring, arguing with the ref or whatever. Stevie is looking over at Vader and he's kind of putting his arms up like, what's going on? Like, you want to get it on? Like, get the fuck out of the ring. You know, that's basically what he's doing. And he mouthed off to Vader or something. And Vader stops exiting the ring. He gets back into the ring. And they just start throwing bombs. And Vader starts shooting on him. And so Stevie's defending himself and he's throwing shots back at Vader. The whole exchange lasted less than like 5 or 6 seconds. It was not like a very long exchange, but they're basically shooting on one another. At Vader, at one point, he's throwing bombs and he may have caught Vader with a left hand. I don't remember. But I know Vader started falling forward. I don't know if he got punched or if it was just the momentum and he was so heavy, but he fell forward and he fell down. He fell flat on his face. He got right back up. And then he went back on the apron and the match continued. And Vader and Cactus won. And then off to the back went Stevie Ray. But you could tell when the match was over, Stevie was not very happy. He was not very happy. And as Stevie tells the story, and he never told Vader this story, so I'm not sure Vader even knew this before he passed away, Stevie was angry. Boy, was he hot about what happened when he got back to the dressing room. He said back then, you know, he didn't really know anybody in the business. He didn't trust anybody. He had only been wrestling maybe a year or two, he and his brother, you know, up to that point. They had not been wrestlers for very long. And so he didn't know anybody, didn't really trust anybody. And wherever he went, in his bag, he carried with him a gun. He carried with him, I think it was a 25 caliber handgun that he kept in his gym bag. He goes to the back. He is so angry. He goes to his bag. He grabs his gun, which is loaded, and he wraps a towel around his hand. The gun is in his hand. He wraps a towel around his hand so nobody can see the gun. And he is just waiting. He is waiting for Vader to walk into the dressing room, and he is going to shoot him. He is going to shoot Vader. He said he was ready to empty the entire clip into this guy. That is how pissed off he was. And Vader walks into the dressing room, and the first thing he does, before Stevie can do or say anything, the first thing he does is he walks up to Stevie and he apologizes for what happened. Now, again, Vader has no idea that this guy has a gun in his hand, but he felt bad. He walked up to Stevie. He apologized for what happened. I don't remember what his excuse was for why he acted that way, if he was upset about something or if somebody was ribbing him. There was some reason, but he said, you know, he was all apologetic. And at that point, Stevie said, once he apologized, all the heat and everything just completely dissipated. He goes, at that point, they were cool. They were cool after that. They never had another problem. And in fact, they would make sure to go over and talk to each other whenever they would see one another at these different like wrestling conventions over the years. They were very friendly with each other. But Vader never knew how close he came to getting offed by Stevie Ray that night at Battle Bowl. Stevie was going to empty the clip in this guy over a stupid incident in the ring. Vader was being stupid, but it was just, you know, it was a dumb incident in the ring. He was going to throw his whole life away. Forget his career. He was going to throw his whole life away over that. And thankfully, it never came to that. Chase from Rapid City, South Dakota. Some guy at Walmart told me that Triple H is half owner of AEW. I don't believe it for a second, but it got me thinking. I have no doubt that this is wrong, but could you put this to rest as well? He told me quite a few people believe it. When your email begins with "some guy at Walmart told me," you've already answered your own question. And Russ from Roselle. Do you think for season 3 of Dark Side of the Ring, it would be too soon to do an episode on Hana Kimura? And I actually answered this also on the Wednesday stream, because I had just gotten the email from Russ. It is never too soon, I think, to draw attention to the issues that kind of plagued Hana Kimura. And in fact, I think it would be timely. And that's considering that it would be at least a year, right? A year, maybe a year and a half. Who knows when we're even going to get the next season of Dark Side of the Ring at all. You know, they're only first thinking of ideas for it now. You've got the whole pandemic thing. They can't just go out and interview all the people they would need to interview for all these episodes. So it would be a while yet before we would even see it. But yeah, I don't think that would be a problem at all. I think that would be a fine choice. I just think there's so many different stories you could tell. Maybe not season three. Maybe it's season four. But would she make for a good subject for the show? Yeah, she would. She would. You know, a lot of people would. China would. Chris Kanyon would. Brian Pillman would. There's a lot of different subjects. But I think, you know, to kind of draw attention to what she went through. And it was more than just the incident on the TV show. But all the ridicule and everything that she went through as a subject for Dark Side of the Ring and what happened to her. I don't think that's off limits. And I don't think it's too soon. You know, but again, to do it for season three, you're not going to see it for at least a year or more. It's not like it's going to be out in 2 months. But I think that would be a good subject to cover as well. If you have questions, keep emailing me. The mailbag is always open. I do read everything you send me. May not always be able to respond, but I do see it all. So thesolemonster@gmail.com is the place to send all of your emails to. Follow me on Twitter. @Solemonster is my handle. I am going live tonight on YouTube after the NXT In Your House pay-per-view is over. I don't know if it's ending at 10. I don't know if it's ending at 9:30. Sometimes those takeover shows, they go a little short, which is great. I love it when they go short. Fine with me. That means I can go live earlier and go to bed earlier. So join me later. I hope you'll choose me for your NXT recap. We'll have some fun on the stream tonight, live on YouTube, and of course, I'll be live on Wednesday night for the Dynamite stream. I'm going to be back here with you for episode 656 next week. Next weekend, the Undertaker documentary returns, episode 4, chapter 4, on the WWE Network, drops next Sunday. Same day as Backlash. Oh, that's right, Backlash, shit. I almost forgot about Backlash. Well, if that's the case, then probably what I'll do is have a predictions video up for Backlash later in the week on the YouTube channel. And that might just be YouTube exclusive. Possibly, we'll see. And then I'll not only be back for 6:56 next Sunday, but I'll be live again on YouTube next Sunday night for the Backlash recap, where we may well get to see the greatest wrestling match ever between Edge and Randy Orton, and the worst wrestling match ever between Braun Strowman and Miz and Morrison. I have a feeling I'm going to have a lot to say about that pay-per-view when it is over. So a lot of good content coming up, and I hope you will join me for all of it. Be well, stay safe, please, wherever you may be, anywhere in the world, all over the world. We have people listening, and I appreciate each and every one of you, and I will join you tonight live on YouTube. I'll see you there for the NXT TakeOver review. Take care, guys.
The Solemonster sounds off.
Viking Raiders driving in their car while Ivar chowed down on a giant drumstick. Because I guess to WWE, that's what all Vikings do. I ordered Popeyes the other day. I don't want a wing. You know, breasts are good too. Nothing wrong with breasts. But the drumsticks are where it's at. I chowed down on a nice drumstick from Popeyes the other day. Does that make me a Viking too?
The Solemonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolemonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solemonster on Twitter @Solemonster.
Solemonster.
Put that cigarette out.
Solemonster Sounds Off.